Welcome to No Save for You, a podcast where I gather my thoughts about tabletop RPGs. My name's Cody. Enjoy the show.
Hey everyone, this is a very special episode. Ray Otis and I have teamed up to talk about Delving Deeper. If you want to catch the second half of our conversation, please head over to Ray's podcast, Plundergrounds, and give it a listen. You really should be listening to Plundergrounds anyway, if you aren't already. So, yeah, get on that.
So, we're going to talk Delving Deeper.
Mm-hmm.
Delving Deeper is a concise rule set written by Simon Bull. Cody, do you know when this thing was written? I guess I don't.
There's several editions. Let's see. So, I have the book in front of me, and the reference rules version 4A is November 2014, it looks like.
Yeah, but that's the fourth version, so they may have come out before that. I would assume they have. But this is what you'd call a retro clone, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. And it is written to emulate the original edition, so the little brown books of D&D. Specifically, it's made to emulate the first three books only, so it stops short of Greyhawk. And that's an interesting thing about retro clones in general, especially retro clones of the original edition, is to know which books they include. Simon did a number of things that made Delving Deeper kind of unique, I think, and kept the flavor of the original rules. He doesn't use a lot of modernized terminology, so you don't see dice notated as like D20, do you?
No. And he doesn't say roll, he says throw. So when you roll a dice, you're throwing a dice.
That's right. You throw a dice. And most of the time, instead of saying like 2d6, you'll see in the text the range of 2 to 12.
2 to 12, yeah.
What else? He keeps this nomenclature of the normal versus hero versus superhero, these kind of levels, three-part levels to the advancement system, which really kind of goes all the way back to chainmail, but it was in there in the little brown books and kind of got subsequently lost.
Yeah, I've never played from the three books, so this was new to me because it's not BX, which is the next edition I am familiar with, I guess, chronologically. So,
right. Other than that, though, it has a lot in common with all the FACO versions of D&D, right? Anything pre third edition, really.
Right.
Fairly interchangeable. Oh, except for the one big difference here, which is the damage.
Oh, yeah. A point of contention for some people.
It really is. It's surprising how contentious. I think that and Ascending Armor class are probably the two most contentious things. Most people, though, can get their head around FACO, but they can't get their head around not having variable damage to weapons.
Right. I had reservations at first as well, but then if you go in, there's a couple of blogs out there that I was reading specifically about this edition of the game or the edition that it's emulating, and you know the combat round is much longer. So if you think about it, if a combat round is 1 minute, you know you can kill someone just as easily with a sword or a dagger in that time frame.
Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of rationalizations. There's weapon speed, so a dagger could strike 2 to 3 times in the same time that a big sword could. Could find chinks in armor once you get past reach. There is some notion about reach. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I kind of like just everything doing a D6.
Me too. It's very fast.
It is very fast. One of that you're never hunting around for the right die. Another thing that matters, I think, is that all weapons are a matter of flavor choice more than they are.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, you don't optimize just because the longsword might be the best mechanical weapon in a variable weapon, you know, damage system, maybe the best one-handed combo with a shield or something. You don't have to go for that one thing.
Yeah, and that's kind of it. We've had that in the Barrow Maze game I'm running right now. Our the main fighter of the group, TJ's character, is actually using a staff. And if that was BX, he'd be getting a D4. And no fighter would ever pick a staff because it only does a D4 damage.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good example. And, you know, there's all kind of arguments to the contrary why you might use variable weapon damage. And it's really just a matter of preference. But it does change the game a little. Overall, original edition is much more constrained in the extremes of ranges. So you don't have nearly as many modifiers. You're lucky to have a +1.
Right.
And the worst you'd ever have is a minus one, but most people don't have either, or most characters. You only do D6s and damage, and so do monsters. There's no monster with an armor class of less than two in the monster part of the book, which is kind of surprising to me.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you noticed the attack matrix only goes down to two. And I'm like, why doesn't it go to zero? Because.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. The actual abbreviation Thaco was not in the little brown book. So that's another reason why he doesn't include it in Delving Deeper. But that concept is there, except that here it's basically, you know, the lowest you can get is a fake two because it doesn't. Yeah, which is kind of funny. You know what? I want to talk about a descending armor class just a little bit too.
That's fine.
And Thaco in general. So you are playing this quite a bit, mostly online, right?
Yeah, exclusively online. I don't have a in person mm-hmm. group. So.
And have you found it awkward at all at the table?
No, not at all. And to be honest, I didn't even really read the book that much before just diving in and running it. Mm-hmm. So my experience with BX or other older games has translated pretty seamlessly.
Mm-hmm. And with Thaco, what's your kind of favorite method in your head of finding the right number? Do you look at the table or do you?
No, I don't use the table. It's so whatever you roll, subtract that from 19, and that's
yes.
Thaco.
It's, yeah.
I never had a character make it high enough level for that to change anyway. They always die before. So.
That's right. That's right. So you take your Thaco. You roll the die and subtract your roll from your Thaco, and that's the armor class you hit.
Right.
That's a good way to do it. That's the way I like to. And then you don't have to reference a table.
Right.
But the other thing I will say about it is people say, well, why was there descending armor class? And there's kind of two reasons. One of them historically was that Gary wanted a roll, a number or better, and so he inverted the armor class, so it's a roll high system. Mm-hmm. The other is that if you look at the way the armor works, once you hit zero and start going into negatives, that's magical armor. So there's a distinction that you can only get past zero with magical means. And so the only creatures with naturally negative armor would be like, well, like I said, there's none in Delving Deeper, but as you get into like AD&D, the demons and some of the, you know, the Demogorgon and some of those big players all have negative armor classes.
Right. Yeah. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I think that's a neat point of distinction.
Yeah,
I guess it'd be kind of like saying you can't get over 20 in fifth edition or something without right. it. But that's not really true. I think you actually can.
Not at all. Yeah, you can get it at first level.
Okay, so let's talk about resources first of all. Where would somebody find Delving Deeper?
The Immersive Inc. website
mm-hmm.
has links to where you can download the PDFs of the individual books or a link to the hypertext. And I almost exclusively, when I'm playing the game, I use the hypertext because I'm already online on Roll20 and Hangouts, you know, having another tab open to reference the rules that I can control F, search for things if I need to, is much faster than me thumbing through a book or looking, you know, through a PDF or whatever.
That's right. Super awesome. Yeah, and those three little, it's cool that it's free. Those three little books are free. I have printed out those little books and, you know, stapled them in zine format before.
Yeah, a couple of my players did that as well.
They're great for reference at the table and the fact that they're divided up. But also you can order through Lulu. You can get a nice little soft cover paperback of it for $5, I think it is.
It's actually cheaper for me. I had a coupon, so I just wait for the coupon to come around.
That's right. If you wait for a coupon, you can get it. You can get it less. But I think that's amazing. And he has, it says edition 4, but really not much has changed since the earliest editions. I've read the third edition anyway, and I've even applied the errata to the softcover book, and it's so minor as to not almost be worth looking in. You know, it's almost not worth writing it in there. So just very fine touches.
Nice. Yeah, I haven't looked back at any of his previous editions, so I couldn't tell you.
Yeah. So he's also released a spreadsheet, right, of the 360 monsters?
Yeah, that was, I think, compiled from the official material, and then I think he also pulled stuff from the source books that Delving Deeper doesn't include. Because I know in Delving Deeper there aren't demons, but if you look at that list, there are demons on the list. So I don't know if he got that from AD&D or... like one of the other supplements for
probably It's kind of interesting to see which of the iconic monsters get in under which edition, right?
Yeah.
Beholders weren't there. Rest monsters weren't there in the beginning.
Yeah, there are some monsters I was looking for in the Barrow Maze game that are like staple monsters that actually aren't in Delving Deeper. But that's the cool thing is it's so easy because you don't have to worry about damage or hit. You know, you say, okay, it's a heroic type, so that's 4 plus hit dice, and it does a d6 damage, and you're off to the races. It's so easy.
It really is. It really is. Plays super well. The other thing, the other resource that I wanted to mention is, if you're really into kind of the history of things, there's a blog called Dispatches from Kick-Assistan, which is kind of a funny name, by Adam Muskowitz. And he interviews Simon Bull on a couple of those, asks him questions about why he made this decision or that decision. And in some ways, that's what finally sold me on this version of a retro clone for original edition, is when I read how intelligently Simon talks about his design choices, I realized that it wasn't just, oh, I like this over that. It was a very studied approach to making the game a cleaner, more streamlined version of those little brown books.
Right. Yeah, I came to it through GaryCon. I had met you there and you were hyping it up. And I was like, all right, well, if Ray's into it, I'm into it, I guess.
So, yeah, let's talk about then your game. You've been running Barrow Maze with Delving Deeper.
I have, yes.
And who else in that game?
So we have the Burrito Baron. You guys might know him as Eric Swanson. He plays in a lot of like the games on the Audio Dungeon. So he's in Kalmata. He's in Forlorn Shores. We've got TJ Drinnen from the... Oh boy, I'm going to butcher this. Triple M and Triple O podcasts. Spike Pit is in there. Who else have we had? God, I feel so bad. I can never keep track of all the players. It's a pretty stable crew of like 3 or 4 people playing each time. Oh, Pete S from the Discord. He's in there as well.
Right. And you guys mostly play on Sunday morning.
Sunday morning. Yeah, that's just the weekends for me. The early mornings are just the best time frame. So,
actually, we should clarify. Sunday morning for those of us who live on the West Coast.
Right. Pacific time. Yeah.
For Colin, who's in England, it's the evening. So
evening. Yeah. Evening. You know what's funny is he showed up to not the last session but the one before in formal attire. It looked like he just got out of church or something. I don't know. He had a necktie. Really, he looked like Jason Statham almost.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's no neckties in D&D. What's going on?
I know. That's what I thought. I told him to take it off. But
but we have established that you can play it without pants as long as you're not that part of you is not on camera.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. Torso up. On your camera, you're fine without pants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jason, just in case you're listening.
That's right.
The rule is no pants is fine. Just don't stand up to go get a drink. And,
yep.
Yeah.
Or if you do, just crouch.
Yeah, you kind of duck walk over to the fridge to get your you have made a few house rules, but not a lot. What's some of the ones that you've implemented?
So I clarified that we wouldn't be using thieves. They're an optional class in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I have a problem with them. I think they actually did a pretty elegant job with it.
Yeah, that's but you know, to be fair, that's not a house rule, right? That's they're optional in the text. And just to real quickly, I would say if you're wondering why you wouldn't include thieves, the article in Philotimus Musings on why no thieves was a real eye opener for me.
That's I read that and I was like, okay, I'm not using thieves.
Mm-hmm.
The other actual house rules is I added a death save. So if you get to 0 hit points, you just save versus poison. If you pass, you live. If you fail, you die. Pretty common. And then I added funerals. So if your character dies, you can take their body back to town. And then the characters who lived can have a funeral service and like buy their XP for gold. And it's kind of a like free carousing.
I really like that addition because they can not only buy the XP gold for, you know, 1 gold per XP, but they also take a few moments when they do that to kind of commemorate the character.
Right. Yeah. So often when my characters die, it's just, you know, everyone's like, okay, just roll up a new guy. And I'm like, well, I like that character. He was kind of important to me. No one says anything about it. So I wanted some way to, and I don't remember where I stole that from. That's not my original idea, but I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
And then weapons. So since everything does a D6, I wanted to give at least a little bit of a like an even spread, because you can wield a one-handed weapon and a shield, and that's an obvious advantage over a two-handed weapon. So I said two-handed weapons get the best of two dice. And then if you're wielding two weapons, which there aren't rules for, but there aren't rules against, then it's just a plus one to the D6 roll.
I do something similar when I play it, and I use dual wielding. I use your two-handed rule. I say you can roll two dice and take the best, which I always feel like to me like that's two weapons, two dice. I don't know, on the two-handed one, I let the if you roll a six, it explodes once.
Explodes.
So you can roll it again and add that to your damage. So theoretically, you could get all the way up to 12,
right?
Which allows this kind of devastating hit from a two-handed weapon.
Right. Yeah, that actually makes sense.
And then you also allow clerics to make scrolls.
Yeah. I don't see really an issue with that. I mean, the magic users can do it, so I just said, clerics can do it the same way.
And then you added magic wands, right?
Magic wands. I stole that right from the Necropraxis blog, which is actually a pretty good resource for this edition of the game. I think a lot of his stuff is coded for 0E.
Yeah, I think so. I actually like that you did both of those, though, because for me, there is a difference, right? Clerics have this advantage of being, the original clerics were more like Templars. They were warrior.
Right. Yeah.
Warrior priests.
Empire hunters and, or warrior priests. Yeah, exactly.
And so if they can do scrolls, then that kind of gives the kind of unbalances, because balances is a dirty word when you're talking about original edition, but it kind of lets them creep up a little more on magic users. So adding wands to magic users kind of maintains that special. But your wands are, so they're kind of elemental wands, right? There's only certain things they can do.
Right. Yeah. I think it's three elements, fire, electric, and I think cold. To be honest, no one has actually engaged with that rule yet, so I haven't had a completely familiarize myself with it. Yeah. And I think it's we have one magic user in the party right now.
Okay.
And I don't know if he actually remembered that that's a thing.
Yeah.
But it's pretty neat. Again, it's just a D6 and then it has like a usage die type mechanic, so every time you use the wand, you check the usage. If it comes up that it runs out, then the wand is no longer magical and you got to make a new one.
Yeah, there's a cost to it. I think what it allows, it's pretty cool. One of the things it allows wizards to do is be magical
all the time. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Which is cool. We'll link to that article, but it's pretty neat. All right. Well, you want to talk about some of the things that might be a little awkward about delving deeper?
Yeah, I guess probably the main one we already talked about is the damage, right?
Yeah.
That's the one.
Initiative, how do you feel about that?
I like the initiative system. I mean, playing BX, just throwing a D6 each side. Typically, that's how I do it in the Barrow Maze, but we have talked about trying to be more free-flowing with it, like how it suggests in the rules. You know, I think it says that, the DM just rules the initiative as he sees fit.
Yeah.
But you can grant initiative to people who have readied actions, like shooting into melee or shooting at a charging opponent or, you know.
One of the things I like about it is it gives you a lot of options there, which is kind of the same as saying it doesn't give you much guidance, but it does give you some, and it's
right. It gives enough, I think.
It does. It's saying base it on the fiction, and the fiction is, I mean, it doesn't literally say that, but it's giving you different things that might affect how you decide what order people go in. And one of those is weapons with reach, for instance, might go before weapons without reach. So there's a distinct advantage for a spear over a dagger.
Right, exactly.
There's a parrying rule, which I haven't played with much, but you mentioned this the other day about why would you ever not parry.
Right, it's pretty... One of the... So Eric Swanson calls it overpowered. We haven't used it yet, but it's... So you don't make an attack, and then your opponent gets -4 on their attack roll. And then there's some... That's the easy part. And then the funky part is what happens if they miss. If you have a lighter weapon than your opponent and they miss, I think you get a free attack on them. So in that case, if you have a dagger and someone hits you with or misses you with a sword when you're parrying, it's almost better to always carry a lighter weapon.
Yeah.
But if they miss and you have the heavier weapon, I think you're disarmed. I may be getting that backwards, but one of them is good and one of them is not so good.
I think you're kind of right. I could see why at first I had the same reactions. Like, why would you ever do anything other than parry? And I think there's a couple of things that would come up if you start playing it very heavily. You can have a standoff situation, right? You can essentially lose your turn by trying to parry and nobody attacking you.
Right.
Or you could be the subject of missile fire.
Right.
Or you could, as the DM, you could be putting a clock on the scenario that puts a lot of pressure on them, and they waste time, you know, standing there trying to fight defensively. They look like a chump.
Right.
I want to play with it some. I haven't played with it much. I really hadn't noticed it until you guys brought it up.
Right.
It's just something I read through and kind of dismissed.
It's almost like every time I read the rules, I find something new, which is kind of interesting.
It is interesting because it doesn't feel like there's that much there.
Right. It's a fairly small book.
Yeah, there's attacking to subdue. There's morale.
Yep.
You've discovered the jousting rules and you're ready to try those out?
Yeah, it has a table that's... I saw it and then I just turned the page because it looked really confusing. But I do want to try it.
I think it models... Yeah, here it is. It's on page 58 if you got the book handy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got results like Lance glances off opponent, Lance broken, opponent struck on helmet, opponent unhorsed. This reminds me a little bit, if you ever played the jousting tournament at GaryCon, that was the chainmail rules for jousting.
The coconut? Is that the coconut?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Where you have two coconuts and you clap them on the table to make the horse sounds.
Yeah.
This one's not quite that detailed, but that one you choose like which side of the shield you're aiming for, whether you're aiming for the head or whatever, and then you compare your targets and check it out. So it's just kind of cool that they offered a little bit of that. That's a little bit of insight, I think, into the medieval war games mindset that started the hobby.
Yeah.
You know, that's something we've lost now. Nobody thinks about tournaments and jousting much.
The one thing about morale that I actually, when I reread it, you know, it gives like specific bonuses or penalties, like evil sorts fighting alongside wraiths always adjust their morale by +1. So even if you're like, you know, 10th level or something, and you're, you know, a wraith is only like, I think it's a heroic type, so 4 to 7 hit dice or something.
Mm-hmm.
They always get +1, which is kind of cool. Fighters 4th level or above add +1 to morale rolls for their friends.
Mm-hmm. Have you run into that the rule yet? Have you played where the fighters get multiple attacks against one hit die opponents?
We have. So TJ is high enough level to get that. I think his character is like 4th level, so he should be doing that. But we haven't. I don't think we realized it was an actual rule until he went back and read it and was like, "Hey,
yeah, it's something kind of cool fighters can do."
Yeah.
But there's not a lot. I mean, to be fair, there's not a ton of that stuff buried in there. Mostly it's just a rule set that gets out of your way and you can play, right?
And if you miss it, it doesn't matter. It's not, you know, game changing, right?
I guess it can be,
but it doesn't break the game if you don't use it.
Yeah, that's, you don't feel like you're doing it wrong if you didn't engage one of those rules.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, that's the first half of this conversation. Like I said, head over to Ray's show and... give it a listen for the second half and just for general excellent podcasting shows. So, Ray, I want to personally thank you for doing this with me. It's been something I've been wanting to talk about for a while now, and I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to sit down and chat with me for a little bit. So, thank you, sir.
Well, folks, thanks for listening. You can find me on Discord and MeWe. Music on this show is by Lobo Loco. And in case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.